Cambridge Certificate of Proficiency in English Listening Test. Ahead Books. Written by Sean Houghton. Test 8. I'm going to give you the instructions for this test. I shall introduce each part of the test and give you time to look at the questions. At the start of each piece, you will hear this sound. You will hear each piece twice. Remember, while you're listening, write your answers on the question paper. You will have 5 minutes at the end of the real test to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. In the exam, there would now be a pause. Please ask any questions you have during the pause, because you must not speak during the test. Now open your question paper and look at part one. You will hear three different extracts. For questions 1 to 6, choose the answer A, B or C, which fits best according to what you hear. There are two questions for each extract. Extract 1. You will hear Professor Clark giving a lecture about mental health for psychology students.
The stigma attached to mental health is very real. Sufferers may convince themselves that they are being brave by keeping their problems pent up inside. However, if they were being honest, I think usually this is because they are afraid of being judged because of that stigma. And not without very good cause. After all, society is less than sympathetic, and this is an issue that we must face and overcome. However, the most courageous thing you can do is hold your hands out and ask for guidance. Trust me, there are some good people out there who will grasp them tightly for dear life and do whatever they can to support you, never letting go. Recently, a celebrity whose name I think you all know spoke out about her own mental health issues. Although her struggle has been ongoing for years, it only came to light this week on account of her brave decision to discuss her issues in public. This celebrity did not fit the stereotype for mental health illness. She was young, beautiful, popular, famous, and hugely successful. And now she is still all those things, and even more. Her preparedness to face the stigma head-on is incredibly laudable, and she has done a true service to all the silent sufferers out there. She is their voice and their hope. Hopefully, they too will now come forward and seek help. The stigma attached to mental health is very real. Sufferers may convince themselves that they are being brave by keeping their problems pent up inside. However, if they were being honest, I think usually this is because they are afraid of being judged because of that stigma. And not without very good cause. After all, society is less than sympathetic, and this is an issue that we must face and overcome. However, the most courageous thing you can do is hold your hands out and ask for guidance. Trust me, there are some good people out there who will grasp them tightly for dear life and do whatever they can to support you, never letting go. Recently, a celebrity whose name I think you all know spoke out about her own mental health issues. Although her struggle has been ongoing for years, it only came to light this week on account of her brave decision to discuss her issues in public. This celebrity did not fit the stereotype for mental health illness. She was young, beautiful, popular, famous, and hugely successful. And now she is still all those things, and even more. Her preparedness to face the stigma head-on is incredibly laudable, and she has done a true service to all the silent sufferers out there. She is their voice and their hope. Hopefully, they too will now come forward and seek help.
Extract 2. You will hear a skiing gold medalist called Julia Braithwaite being interviewed on a radio talk show.
A hero's welcome today for Julia Braithwaite, who joins me on the show hot on the heels of her success in the World Championships. Julia, how does it feel to be the first gold medal winner from this country?
Extremely satisfying. Coming from a minority sport in this country as I do, there has always been a serious challenge in obtaining sponsorship and funding.
I would have thought your biggest hurdle, Julia, would obviously have been the lack of snow.
Well, actually, it is not the snow we are lacking as such, but the winter sports facilities. There is sufficient snow depth in some of our ranges to accommodate such facilities, believe it or not, during the winter months. Of course, I had to go abroad, but my hope is that my success will generate sufficient interest in winter sports to prompt the government to provide these facilities. I'm not suggesting an "if you build it, they will come" attitude. That could be potentially wasteful. But what I am saying is that if the appetite is really there, we ought to be whetting it.
Was the dearth of facilities indeed the greatest challenge you had to overcome, then?
The most distressing thing for me was that I am a home bird and very dearly love those in my nest, so to speak. I had ample access to state-of-the-art facilities from my base in Bern once I'd acquired sufficient funding, which was no small chore. But, as I said, that necessitated being abroad for the vast majority of the time.
A hero's welcome today for Julia Braithwaite, who joins me on the show hot on the heels of her success in the World Championships. Julia, how does it feel to be the first gold medal winner from this country?
Extremely satisfying. Coming from a minority sport in this country as I do, there has always been a serious challenge in obtaining sponsorship and funding.
I would have thought your biggest hurdle, Julia, would obviously have been the lack of snow.
Well, actually, it is not the snow we are lacking as such, but the winter sports facilities. There is sufficient snow depth in some of our ranges to accommodate such facilities, believe it or not, during the winter months. Of course, I had to go abroad, but my hope is that my success will generate sufficient interest in winter sports to prompt the government to provide these facilities. I'm not suggesting an "if you build it, they will come" attitude. That could be potentially wasteful. But what I am saying is that if the appetite is really there, we ought to be whetting it.
Was the dearth of facilities indeed the greatest challenge you had to overcome, then?
The most distressing thing for me was that I am a home bird and very dearly love those in my nest, so to speak. I had ample access to state-of-the-art facilities from my base in Bern once I'd acquired sufficient funding, which was no small chore. But, as I said, that necessitated being abroad for the vast majority of the time.
Extract 3. You will hear a reporter called Inga giving a radio update on an industrial relations dispute.
Inga Muller now joins me for the latest on the threatened industrial action involving the Transport Workers Union. Inga, what is the current state of things?
Well, talks are continuing here as both sides burn the midnight oil, hoping to reach a compromise that would prevent the scheduled strike action, which is expected to cause untold levels of disruption. However, the air of optimism from earlier in the day appears to have evaporated and the signs of a resolution are bleak. Should the talks break down, a lightning strike is due to go ahead, closing all southern rail networks. The worst part for commuters is not yet knowing what will happen.
What seems to be the sticking point?
Well, the dispute over pay increases held the talks up from progressing for quite some time, but appears to have been overcome now. The new working hours have not gone down brilliantly, but the union was prepared to compromise on that, on condition of assurances regarding improved benefits. But management is digging in when it comes to this, leading to the current stalemate.
Inga Muller now joins me for the latest on the threatened industrial action involving the Transport Workers Union. Inga, what is the current state of things?
Well, talks are continuing here as both sides burn the midnight oil, hoping to reach a compromise that would prevent the scheduled strike action, which is expected to cause untold levels of disruption. However, the air of optimism from earlier in the day appears to have evaporated, and the signs of a resolution are bleak. Should the talks break down, a lightning strike is due to go ahead, closing all southern rail networks. The worst part for commuters is not yet knowing what will happen.
What seems to be the sticking point?
Well, the dispute over pay increases held the talks up from progressing for quite some time, but appears to have been overcome now. The new working hours have not gone down brilliantly, but the union was prepared to compromise on that, on condition of assurances regarding improved benefits. But management is digging in when it comes to this, leading to the current stalemate.
That is the end of part one. Now turn to part two. You will hear arboriculturist Marcella Im discussing her job on a radio program. For questions 7 to 15, complete the sentences with a word or short phrase. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part two.
Wonderful. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me on the show. Now, as I was saying, my job title is arboriculturist, which is a bit of a mouthful, I'll grant you. But perhaps my role is better known by another name, so you can call me a tree surgeon if you like. I don't mind. Although the roles are actually not quite the same, but don't call me a horticulturist. Then you're into a closely related but very different field. Not all of us culturists do the same work, you see. The viniculturists, for example, seem to have all the fun. Not that I'm jealous, mind you. So what do I do? Well, mainly, I cultivate and manage trees, hedges and shrubs. That is, in a nutshell, what my role involves. I work in both rural and urban areas, and each present their own set of challenges. One of the biggest challenges in urban areas, for example, is working out how trees can inhabit the concrete jungle safely and in harmony with the buildings and people around them. My work will regularly require me to use specialist equipment and machinery. For instance, I am very familiar with the inside of a climbing harness. After all, it is often necessary to climb high up into trees to remove loose branches and so forth. The choice of whether to use a rope and harness or modern machinery, such as a crane, for a job is usually dependent on two factors, accessibility and height. If I can get a lifting machine into the area and if it can take me up sufficiently high in the tree, then I will invariably choose this option today because using modern machinery is much safer and more convenient than employing traditional methods. The most common activity I tend to do in my day-to-day work is thinning, which involves making the branches and foliage on mature trees less dense. This could be to promote growth, for safety reasons, or for a number of other purposes. Some would say that technically makes me an arborist, an actual tree surgeon, not an arboriculturist. What's the difference? Well, an arborist is mostly involved in planting, thinning, and groundwork, while an arboriculturist tends to operate in a supervisory role or a managerial capacity. They would, for example, select suitable trees for a given environment and design landscaping schemes. However, I work in a hands-on role only by choice. I also run my own consultancy business, where I am at the top of the hierarchical pyramid, involved in all major decision-making. Being honest, I prefer the hands-on work, but it is my consultancy that pays the biggest bills at the end of the day, so my motivation for running it is mainly financial. I value the business very much, and the benefits I enjoy as a consequence of owning it. There is a lot of paperwork and official correspondence involved, though, which I find quite tedious. For example, I must carry out tree inspections and surveys and compile reports for the likes of engineers, solicitors, mortgage brokers and insurance companies. I also do work for the local council in terms of reviewing planning applications. There are a number of vested interests in such projects, so naturally working on them is very different to my arborist work. I need a very different skill set, and I must function as part of a team and communicate effectively, both of which are challenging when you work with people from all walks of life. That said, it is the former which I struggled with most initially on opening up my consultancy, as I had been so used to playing it solo on projects, as it were, for so long. Now there are a number of different factors which can affect all of these projects going forward.
Now you will hear part two again.
Yes, that's wonderful. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me on the show. Now, as I was saying, my job title is arboriculturist, which is a bit of a mouthful, I'll grant you. But perhaps my role is better known by another name, so you can call me a tree surgeon if you like. I don't mind. Although the roles are actually not quite the same, but don't call me a horticulturist. Then you're into a closely related but very different field. Not all of us culturists do the same work, you see. The viniculturists, for example, seem to have all the fun. Not that I'm jealous, mind you. So what do I do? Well, mainly, I cultivate and manage trees, hedges and shrubs. That is, in a nutshell, what my role involves. I work in both rural and urban areas, and each present their own set of challenges. One of the biggest challenges in urban areas, for example, is working out how trees can inhabit the concrete jungle safely and in harmony with the buildings and people around them. My work will regularly require me to use specialist equipment and machinery. For instance, I am very familiar with the inside of a climbing harness. After all, it is often necessary to climb high up into trees to remove loose branches and so forth. The choice of whether to use a rope and harness, or modern machinery, such as a crane, for a job is usually dependent on two factors, accessibility and height. If I can get a lifting machine into the area and if it can take me up sufficiently high in the tree, then I will invariably choose this option today because using modern machinery is much safer and more convenient than employing traditional methods. The most common activity I tend to do in my day-to-day work is thinning, which involves making the branches and foliage on mature trees less dense. This could be to promote growth, for safety reasons, or for a number of other purposes. Some would say that technically makes me an arborist, an actual tree surgeon, not an arboriculturist. What's the difference? Well, an arborist is mostly involved in planting, thinning, and groundwork, while an arboriculturist tends to operate in a supervisory role or a managerial capacity. They would, for example, select suitable trees for a given environment and design landscaping schemes. However, I work in a hands-on role only by choice. I also run my own consultancy business, where I am at the top of the hierarchical pyramid, involved in all major decision-making. Being honest, I prefer the hands-on work, but it is my consultancy that pays the biggest bills at the end of the day, so my motivation for running it is mainly financial. I value the business very much, and the benefits I enjoy as a consequence of owning it. There is a lot of paperwork and official correspondence involved, though, which I find quite tedious. For example, I must carry out tree inspections and surveys and compile reports for the likes of engineers, solicitors, mortgage brokers and insurance companies. I also do work for the local council in terms of reviewing planning applications. There are a number of vested interests in such projects, so, naturally, working on them is very different to my arborist work. I need a very different skill set, and I must function as part of a team and communicate effectively, both of which are challenging when you work with people from all walks of life. That said, it is the former which I struggled with most initially on opening up my consultancy, as I had been so used to playing it solo on projects, as it were, for so long. Now there are a number of different factors which can affect all of these projects.
That is the end of part two. Now turn to part three. You will hear a radio program in which two people, Janet Jennings and Hal Brentford, are discussing corporate tax rates. For questions 16 to 20, choose the answer A, B, C or D, which fits best according to what you hear. You now have 1 minute in which to look at part three. Here with me today to discuss the controversial corporation tax policy employed by our government are tax expert Janet Jennings and director of global tech company LED Blending Solutions, Hal Brentford. Hal, first to you. Your company employs the benefits of our favourable tax business rates. Why, in your view, are they justified?
Well, Giles, I think there is a lot of misinformation in the public domain spread by the media about the tax system, and I would like to set the record straight. First of all, the low business tax rates in this country attract global businesses to set up here. These businesses, in turn, provide huge numbers of skilled jobs. Let's not forget that companies like mine employ hundreds of thousands of people. This generates a lot of income tax revenue for the government, not to mention saves it having to pay more social welfare benefits. So while businesses like mine do pay low tax rates, we support the government indirectly in other ways that, I believe, justify these tax incentives.
I take Hal's point, Giles, indeed. It is important for a small economy like ours to attract international investment, and low rates of tax are certainly one way of doing this. However, I think we must be careful to ensure that we attract the right types of companies. There's a danger if our tax rates are too low that companies will set up here for the wrong reasons. I also believe we undersell ourselves. Were our tax rates slightly higher, I think we would still represent an attractive investment opportunity for many big corporations on account of our skilled and youthful workforce.
How would you respond to that? Would your company have invested here if the business tax rates were less favourable?
Well, remember that we are an established company here now, embedded locally. We are here for the long run, regardless of whether or not the tax conditions change. However, the global economy is extremely competitive, and this is not the only country to boast a skilled workforce. I think a low tax rate is key to continuing to attract new investment, which, in turn, is vital for continued growth and prosperity.
So, if tax rates were raised significantly tomorrow, for argument's sake, you don't think this would result in some of the key international employers set up here abandoning the country?
Absolutely not. You see, once companies like mine establish themselves here, we make a long-term commitment. It is simply not practical to suddenly up sticks and leave. We are too heavily invested in this project, for example, to abandon it now. That is my very point. The low tax rate attracts businesses which, in turn, will reward the policy with a long-term commitment. However, raising the tax rate substantially would, I believe, create a lot of ill will and would make other potential investors think twice. We look for stable economic conditions wherever we invest. If the tax policy were to change dramatically all of a sudden, and the country were to become less business-friendly, this would scare off potential investors.
I'm not sure that the evidence backs up Hal's claims, actually. For instance, we have one of the lowest corruption rates of the developed world, one of its hardest working and most productive workforces, and state-of-the-art technological, education and transport infrastructure. Surely, Hal, these are more important factors than the tax rate, or are you suggesting otherwise?
I don't dispute any of this, Janet. However, these characteristics are not as unique to the country as they used to be. Other countries have realized how important it is to improve transparency and fight corruption and so on, and are making great strides in that direction. I don't suggest that the tax rate is the be-all and end-all and the only deal-maker for prospective investors, but I think it is one of the vital components in any company's investment decision, as I already said, and to suggest otherwise is a bit fantastical. As other countries catch up, the tax rate becomes more and more important. Therefore, I believe we benefit from maintaining the low rates, and whilst I do not think a higher rate would be totally detrimental, I think it would be a mistake and definitely put off some potential new investors, a shift the effects of which are likely to be seen more in the long run than immediately. Furthermore, there is more evidence that this...
Now you will hear part three again. Here with me today to discuss the controversial corporation tax policy employed by our government are tax expert Janet Jennings and director of global tech company LED Blending Solutions, Hal Brentford. Hal, first to you. Your company employs the benefits of our favourable tax business rates. Why, in your view, are they justified?
Well, Giles, I think there is a lot of misinformation in the public domain spread by the media about the tax system, and I would like to set the record straight. First of all, the low business tax rates in this country attract global businesses to set up here. These businesses, in turn, provide huge numbers of skilled jobs. Let's not forget that companies like mine employ hundreds of thousands of people. This generates a lot of income tax revenue for the government, not to mention saves it having to pay more social welfare benefits. So while businesses like mine do pay low tax rates, we support the government indirectly in other ways that, I believe, justify these tax incentives.
I take Hal's point, Giles, indeed. It is important for a small economy like ours to attract international investment, and low rates of tax are certainly one way of doing this. However, I think we must be careful to ensure that we attract the right types of companies. There's a danger if our tax rates are too low that companies will set up here for the wrong reasons. I also believe we undersell ourselves. Were our tax rates slightly higher, I think we would still represent an attractive investment opportunity for many big corporations on account of our skilled and youthful workforce.
How would you respond to that? Would your company have invested here if the business tax rates were less favourable?
Well, remember that we are an established company here now, embedded locally. We are here for the long run, regardless of whether or not the tax conditions change. However, the global economy is extremely competitive, and this is not the only country to boast a skilled workforce. I think a low tax rate is key to continuing to attract new investment, which, in turn, is vital for continued growth and prosperity.
So, if tax rates were raised significantly tomorrow, for argument's sake, you don't think this would result in some of the key international employers set up here abandoning the country?
Absolutely not. You see, once companies like mine establish themselves here, we make a long-term commitment. It is simply not practical to suddenly up sticks and leave. We are too heavily invested in this project, for example, to abandon it now. That is my very point. The low tax rate attracts businesses which, in turn, will reward the policy with a long-term commitment. However, raising the tax rate substantially would, I believe, create a lot of ill will and would make other potential investors think twice. We look for stable economic conditions wherever we invest. If the tax policy were to change dramatically all of a sudden, and the country were to become less business-friendly, this would scare off potential investors.
I'm not sure that the evidence backs up Hal's claims, actually. For instance, we have one of the lowest corruption rates of the developed world, one of its hardest working and most productive workforces, and state-of-the-art technological, education and transport infrastructure. Surely, Hal, these are more important factors than the tax rate, or are you suggesting otherwise?
I don't dispute any of this, Janet. However, these characteristics are not as unique to the country as they used to be. Other countries have realized how important it is to improve transparency and fight corruption and so on, and are making great strides in that direction. I don't suggest that the tax rate is the be-all and end-all and the only deal-maker for prospective investors, but I think it is one of the vital components in any company's investment decision, as I already said, and to suggest otherwise is a bit fantastical. As other countries catch up, the tax rate becomes more and more important. Therefore, I believe we benefit from maintaining the low rates, and whilst I do not think a higher rate would be totally detrimental, I think it would be a mistake and definitely put off some potential new investors, a shift the effects of which are likely to be seen more in the long run than immediately. Furthermore, there is more evidence that this...
That is the end of Part 3. Now turn to Part 4. Part 4 consists of two tasks. You will hear five short extracts in which people talk about being self-employed. Look at Task 1. For questions 21 to 25, choose from the list A to H how each speaker feels about being self-employed. Now look at Task 2. For questions 26 to 30, choose from the list A to H what each speaker suggests they are likely to do next in their career. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at Part 4. Speaker 1.
It started out as a labour of love. However, somewhere along the line, many, many moons ago, I lost the love and now it's labour, pure and simple. At first, freelancing seemed like quite an attractive prospect, and the idea of being my own boss was quite appealing. However, the lack of job security is very unsettling, and the financial pressures are constant. The strain has taken its toll on me, and I feel old before my time. Friends have suggested that I take early retirement, but they are unaware of just how precarious my financial position is. I feel the situation will inevitably come to a head before long, and I'm at a crossroads now, where I must decide whether to stick it out and persevere working independently, or try to find an in-house position. The latter option is preferable, and I have just been successful in a second and final interview for something I recently applied for, so perhaps there is light at the end of the tunnel yet.
Speaker 2.
When I was made redundant, the situation almost got the better of me. However, now I realise that it was actually the making of me. Rather than allow myself to get completely overwhelmed, I decided to reinvent myself as an independent contractor. I had lost my job solely on account of the economic conditions, so I remained ultra-confident in my own capabilities. Besides, I left with a glowing reference and excellent connections, So this has enabled me to speedily develop my own network of clients and amass a number of lucrative contracts. Financially, therefore, I am a little strained, and I am very content with the status quo. I see myself continuing to work as an independent contractor and would never dream of surrendering my newfound independence for the security of an office job again, though I will not be working on indefinitely. My success has meant the prospect of hanging up the boots, so to speak, for good, is very real and indeed imminent.
Speaker 3.
My work is my vocation. I live and breathe my job and am truly enthused when I get up each new day about what lies ahead. There are, of course, trade-offs to being self-employed. Salaried positions are undoubtedly more secure and come with perks such as health and pension benefits. However, foregoing such benefits is a small sacrifice when you enjoy what you do to the extent that I can truly claim. I could never get the same satisfaction being in-house. I'm not financially very secure, I must admit, and I will probably have to work well past the normal retirement age, which is approaching quickly. Hold off on the retirement party, I often tell my friends. That's some time away yet. They are aghast at me when I explain that I intend working well into my 70s. Truly, so long as I am fit and healthy enough to do so. But why not? After all, my work does not and has never felt remotely like a chore.
Speaker 4.
I turned down a lucrative role in one of the big five accounting firms to set up my own practice 5 years ago. They offered me a directorship to stay with the company with an outrageous salary. My only regret is not having made the break sooner, however. But I learned an important lesson. You cannot allow yourself to be riddled by fear of the unknown. I have never enjoyed being managed and always wanted to be my own boss, but I was afraid to go outside of my comfort zone, so I stayed in-house stagnating. Now I have a vibrancy about me again that I can hardly believe. Working for myself is invigorating, and I have never felt better. The only problem I face now is that of my own success. My business is growing at a rate that I can no longer sustain on my own, so I have to ask myself, am I prepared to take the risk and allow it to continue to grow by becoming an employer? Well, if past experience has taught me anything, it is to be brave. The only thing to fear is the status quo.
Speaker 5.
I've never worked in-house, and though I enjoy being my own boss, I must admit that I do wonder what life is like on the other side. I think my curiosity is sufficiently strong that I would like to find out one day before I retire. Indeed, I may do so sooner rather than later, as my business has got to the point now where I would have to start hiring staff to cover the workload, and whatever about being my own boss, I'm not keen to manage others. Therefore, I think my next move is obvious. However, I'm in no great rush to go in that direction and start applying yet. Give it a few more months at least.
Now you will hear part 4 again. Speaker 1.
It started out as a labour of love. However, somewhere along the line, many, many moons ago, I lost the love and now it's labour, pure and simple. At first, freelancing seemed like quite an attractive prospect, and the idea of being my own boss was quite appealing. However, the lack of job security is very unsettling, and the financial pressures are constant. The strain has taken its toll on me, and I feel old before my time. Friends have suggested that I take early retirement, but they are unaware of just how precarious my financial position is. I feel the situation will inevitably come to a head before long, and I'm at a crossroads now, where I must decide whether to stick it out and persevere working independently, or try to find an in-house position. The latter option is preferable, and I have just been successful in a second and final interview for something I recently applied for, so perhaps there is light at the end of the tunnel yet.
Speaker 2.
When I was made redundant, the situation almost got the better of me. However, now I realize that it was actually the making of me. Rather than allow myself to get completely overwhelmed, I decided to reinvent myself as an independent contractor. I had lost my job solely on account of the economic conditions, so I remained ultra-confident in my own capabilities. Besides, I left with a glowing reference and excellent connections, so this has enabled me to speedily develop my own network of clients and amass a number of lucrative contracts. Financially, therefore, I am a little strained, and I am very content with the status quo. I see myself continuing to work as an independent contractor and would never dream of surrendering my newfound independence for the security of an office job again, though I will not be working on indefinitely. My success has meant the prospect of hanging up the boots, so to speak, for good, is very real and indeed imminent.
Speaker 3.
My work is my vocation. I live and breathe my job and am truly enthused when I get up each new day about what lies ahead. There are, of course, trade-offs to being self-employed. Salaried positions are undoubtedly more secure and come with perks such as health and pension benefits. However, foregoing such benefits is a small sacrifice when you enjoy what you do to the extent that I can truly claim. I could never get the same satisfaction being in-house. I'm not financially very secure, I must admit, and I will probably have to work well past the normal retirement age, which is approaching quickly. Hold off on the retirement party, I often tell my friends. That's some time away yet. They are aghast at me when I explain that I intend working well into my 70s. Truly, so long as I am fit and healthy enough to do so. But why not? After all, my work does not and has never felt remotely like a chore.
Speaker 4.
I turned down a lucrative role in one of the big five accounting firms to set up my own practice 5 years ago. They offered me a directorship to stay with the company with an outrageous salary. My only regret is not having made the break sooner, however. But I learned an important lesson. You cannot allow yourself to be riddled by fear of the unknown. I have never enjoyed being managed and always wanted to be my own boss, but I was afraid to go outside of my comfort zone, so I stayed in-house stagnating. Now I have a vibrancy about me again that I can hardly believe. Working for myself is invigorating, and I have never felt better. The only problem I face now is that of my own success. My business is growing at a rate that I can no longer sustain on my own, so I have to ask myself, am I prepared to take the risk and allow it to continue to grow by becoming an employer? Well, if past experience has taught me anything, it is to be brave. The only thing to fear is the status quo.
Speaker 5.
I've never worked in-house, and though I enjoy being my own boss, I must admit that I do wonder what life is like on the other side. I think my curiosity is sufficiently strong that I would like to find out one day before I retire. Indeed, I may do so sooner rather than later, as my business has got to the point now where I would have to start hiring staff to cover the workload and whatever about being my own boss, I'm not keen to manage others. Therefore, I think my next move is obvious. However, I'm in no great rush to go in that direction and start applying yet. Give it a few more months at least.
That is the end of part 4. In the actual test, there would now be a pause of 5 minutes for you to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. Be sure to follow the numbering of all the questions. The examiner shall remind you when there's 1 minute left, so that you're sure to finish in time.